13. Now, before we go on, there's just a couple of points. One is you changed company commander at this point. It was no longer Bannerman, was it?
Bannerman had left us in the Western Desert. His desert sores had been intermediated out. He was succeeded by David Douglas. All our, after the first, rather absurd raid on Mactula, after that, Donald Bannerman left us, and David Douglas commanded the company for all that Sidi Barani affair.
Sorry, that's right. It was David was replaced as well by Major.
Yes, David was sent off to command another company, and we had a new company commander, a chap called Crisp Clark, with a hyphen, Jackie Crisp Clark, and he was a Somerset Light Infantryman. Good chap.
What was he like?
He knew his stuff inside out. He'd been a soldier for some years before the war. He had seen some action with the Somerset Light Infantry, and he'd come to the Camerons. There was a system called accelerated promotion, and if in a regiment there was, if you like, a blockage of too many majors, shall we say, and there wasn't a chance of promotion for captains of well-deserved promotion, you could, by the War Office doing it, I suppose, you could get switched, if you so wanted, to another regiment. For instance, the chap who commanded our D Company, great chap, he had come on accelerated promotion from, I think, the Gordon Highlanders. But that had been long ago, and he'd been with the Camerons for some time. Jackie Crisp Clark, I think, he came to us pretty well at this time. So really he had very little time to get to know us all, certainly in the company.
Now, you were made second in command of C Company, as 15 platoons.
Yes, well, there was a nominal, I mean, I was the only other officer in it. There were just two of us. So I could have called myself, I suppose, commander of three different platoons and second in command as well. But we didn't see much of Jackie because he was at this place, Agadir. The entire division was committed to the attack. In fact, two divisions, because the two brigades of the 5th Division were also involved around the other edge of Agadir trying to break through. In our division, the Indian troops in our brigade were trying to climb up a pig of a hill.
Would that be Mount Cochin?
Yes, right. Which was very well, they had good fortifications, well planned in advance, the Italians, and they fought very well. And it really was a murderous job. And then it was so much so that the brigadier decided that the way to do it was take a risk and send the Camerons. There was a flat, sandy plateau at the base of this mountain, some distance away from the parallel range of mountains. And he decided he'd send the Camerons round the foot of Mount Cochin to sort of cut it off in the hope that the Italian gunners, who were brilliant, at the parallel line of hills wouldn't do us too much damage as we advanced. So this we did, and of course we got a great deal of fire from Mount Cochin, but it was plunging fire, you know, coming straight down on us, which by definition is less damaging than enfiladed fire on the level, because there's only one target at a time, not a whole row of them. Even so, it caused damage. Jackie Crisp Clark was wounded, and I think later died of wounds, but he was put out of action there. Sergeant Horbury was killed outright. The gunners on the distant ridge, distant parallel ridge, the source pretty quickly, obviously, the people on Cochin signaled that they were there. So odd shells started coming down, and there was a tank or two. Our second in command, Colin Duncan, we did have two infantry tanks, I tanks, attached to us. Now, we'd had these in the Sidi Barani and the Nebewa attacks, and they were bigger, as well as being slower and more cumbersome, than any tanks that the Italians had. They only had very light sort of scouting tanks. And word came back from the Indian troops on top of Cochin that there was a bunch of these Italian tanks just round the corner from where we were advancing, and we'd better look out. So Colin Duncan jumped into one of these two I tanks and led the way round the corner, and more or less demolished the Italian tanks there. The I tank only, I think, had a 2-pounder gun, and really was only armor plated against not much more than rifle fire. But it was too much for these Italian tanks. And only one came cruising out and cruising around, but didn't do us any particular harm. And then we went on, and we reached the road which led from Agadat back a long way, long, good many miles back, to Asmara, the capital. And the Italians were terribly subject to a fear of being cut off from behind. And if you could get round, they'd almost certainly start withdrawing. And although we were only a battalion, there's no way we could stop an Italian withdrawal. They did start pulling in from all their positions. And that, in effect, was really the end of that particular action. It would have been...
How had you been under fire? It's the first time you've been under heavy fire, from the sound of it. How had you responded yourself?
Well, I suppose I had been under fire of one sort at three times. This was certainly much more intense than anything I'd experienced before. On the other hand, I had more responsibility because by this time, I suppose by being made second in command, or called that, it meant that actually I was in command of Galloway and Chucky Bain, the two PSMs. So in a way, and certainly after Jackie was hit, I was in command of the company. I felt so much to do. Keeping things moving. It was a great thing. I mean, the fatal thing would have been to stop, but keep moving in a controlled way and in the right direction. But in a sense, I hadn't time to be as frightened as all that. This is where the officer, of course, has a huge advantage over the soldier, because if he has things to do, he has to do them. And while he's doing them, he really can't wet his pants because he's got too much on his mind. The soldier, very often, particularly if it's in a defensive position, has only too much time to think about what's going on.
How did you react to the loss of your sergeant? He'd been important.
I read the whole, all were. He was the last man in the world who ever courted popularity, and therefore he was really deeply loved, particularly, of course, by the people who'd been his friends for 10, 12, 15 years, served with him from the very beginning. And I'd known him for, 5 months, 6 months or something. And I must say, I was very, very cut up about that. To be quite blunt, I mean, Jackie Chris Clark, I hardly knew. And so I'm tut-tut, very sorry. Very sorry not to have a company commander. But Horbury was not only a marvellous sergeant and a marvellous instructor, taught me all sorts of things. without trying to teach me. In some cases, perhaps he didn't even know he was teaching me. But I missed him enormously. He was the best platoon sergeant I've ever come across, I think. I was certainly the one I knew best at most close quarters.
So, who took over as far
well,
as...
Well, for a bit there was nobody. Because, again, there had been other casualties, officer casualties. And since the battle proper was over, I could be left with C Company. And, in fact, I had plenty to do because we came across a great good fortune, an entire Italian mule train, which had been abandoned by its drivers. The drivers, the muleteers, had been Eritreans. And even I can see that what lay ahead of us, of what we'd already gone round, mule was not going to be worth their weight in gold. And it was very good for the company because nothing soldiers like more than doing something offbeat, which is quite outside their normal experience. And these poor brutes, of course, had been out in the sun for hours and all, you know, a day and a half, more or less, I suppose. So there was a question of off-saddling them. There was water daily, and then watering them by because they went mad at the smell of water. They were so thirsty. And so there was, you know, kicking and shoving and cursing from the jocks when they got the wrong end of a mule. But it was very good for everybody to have something so out of the normal to do. And eventually, it was, we had a lot more mules later. But these were the first mules we had.
Now, what about your replacement officer was, what, Alan Cameron?
Yes.
What was he like?
He was a very good chap. He had been commissioned. He'd been a sergeant or sergeant major in the Scots Guards. He'd been commissioned as earlier David Douglas had been, as later PSN Bain was going to be commissioned. But unlike David Douglas, he'd been sent to another regiment, you see, to us, instead of having his commission as an ensign in the Scots Guards. He was almost called Alan George, because we already had an Alan Cameron. We'd sent a good many Camerons. So he was always Alan George. And at that time, he was a second lieutenant, just as I was. He'd been a soldier, of course, for X years longer than I had been. And he took over command of the company. But it was command, the two-second lieutenants, which is not my usual arrangement. And I got on with him like a house on fire. And we never had any difficulties or problems. Luckily, we still had our marvellous CSM, what he read. And our CQMS, I think, had John Connell had left us when we left Egypt. And we had a new one, but whose name at the moment I forget. We had, instead of Sergeant Horbury, there was a very good sergeant from the new draft, Sergeant Ramage. And Washi Reed was a great help and suggested to me, this is before Alan George Cameron came along, who I should make up as at least acting or temporary corporals and sergeants to make up for the casualties that we'd had. And his advice was very sound. And one of his advice, he said, I know he's new to us, but this chap Ramage is going to be good. And he's the person that 15 to 2 should have.
And how did you get on with him?
Very well. You're never the same as Horbury. But I perhaps by this time was feeling that in Horbury's case, he knew far more than I did about everything. But in Ramage's case, I knew slightly more than he did, I think, about action at least. So I felt a good deal, I was perfectly confident in telling him what to do.
Now, what's happened next? The next thing would be really the approach to Kerin, wouldn't it?
Yes. Why the again, resumed the old thing of the Sudan Defence Force whizzing up the road, only stopping when heavy fire prevented them, and then rushing around and doing us and circling movement, taking some prisoners and killing a few, and then rushing on again after the retreating enemy. Until we came to, we were following them, by this time not on foot, but some divisional transport had been made available as well as our own. So we were getting along on three tunnels and keeping pretty close up behind the SDF, Sudan Defence Force patrols, or advance guard. And the whole thing came to a sudden halt when we reached a dry watercourse in this time of year, a wadi, with a bridge across it, which had been blown up by Italian engineers. And the bed of the wadi, which was perfectly dry, I mean, driven across it with no problem at all, had been heavily mined. And so everything came to a stop. There's no way of mending the bridge. But the mines had to be detected and then exploded before troops or vehicles, of course, could cross the body and continue. And that was a slow business because they'd been well laid and in sort of sand or sandy earth, the bed of the old riverbed in the wadi. You couldn't see where they were. Sometimes in earth you can see the earth being displaced and moved as the mines had been put in position. Here you couldn't, and it was all a question of people lying in their belly and probing. And this was done by the Indian engineers. They still had the old name, sappers and miners. Sappers being the people who drove tunnels under walls, under fortifications, and miners being the people that put explosives up these tunnels to blow down the wall. They were first rate. The chap, a Sikh officer, who was awarded the VC later for his work in this mine clearance operation. Because we didn't know anything about Italian mines. Nobody knew quite what they, or at least the mines being used down here, what they were like, how they exploded, and so finding them was a very tricky business. And while this delay, which I suppose was 12 hours at least, really meant, I think, that this is why we then had to spend nearly 3 months fighting the next battle, because the defences were perfected of that. The blowing up of half a hillside took place while we were stuck for 12 hours before we could get there.
Now, what was the nature of the Italian defences at Keren? If you could sort of set the scene for us. When had you got there? Do you know the month or date? The end of January was the last battle.
I think it must have been towards the third week of February, something, yes, towards the end of February, I think. As well as their splendid roads, the Italians, when they first colonized Eritrea, had built, like all colonial powers did, and railway lines, of course. And there was a railway line from Massawa, the coast, up as far as Asmara, then across to Keren. Fine. Keren is a small town, bigger than a village, at the foot of a high range of mountains. The whole thing, Asmara and Keren, were up on a plateau at about 6,000 feet, and the hills went up another 3,000 feet plus. To get to Keren, railway and the road had to go through a very narrow gorge through these mountains. The railway, of course, went along the side of the hill. It had been built long before the road, with tunnels taking it through bits of hill that bulged out. The road ran down near the bottom of the gorge and had obviously been blasted out of what had been sheer hillside. This meant that it was very easy to repeat the operation and blast a lot more hillside down on top of the road. And this had been started, I think, the moment that they felt that Agadat was in danger. And they carried on doing it and put the finishing touches to it while we were held up at this wretched wadi crossing. Having done this, they then sent troops up to the, as fast as they could, to the tops of the hills, either side of the gorge through which the X, by now X road, ran. So we found ourselves emerging into quite a big flat plain, surrounded on all sides by these mountains. But you could see the road snaking away in the distance towards the end of the plain, towards the mountains. And when you can get a bit nearer, you realize that this was being held by the enemy. It wasn't quite clear in what form. And the Sudan Defense Force patrols had approached and been very ferociously shot at. So we knew that the road was blocked, or at least held, and it was decided that because the SDF had drawn so much fire and such strength that this roadblock was, or road position, was well manned. And it was decided, therefore, that the only thing to do was, like Northwest Frontier fighting, was to get our chaps up on the hills, too. And so the Camerons, we were in front, and so we were first off.
Now, what were you attacking? It was later on called Cameron Ridge, I suppose.
Yes.
Which is sort of in front of Briggs Peak and Sancho. Yeah,
well, it looked from the ground, the very inadequate maps, of course, it looked from the ground like one continuous mountain with odd dips and things in it. But it did also appear that there was, above the line of the railway, which I suppose was about 1,000 feet up from the valley floor, there was another 1,500 feet, so another 1,000 feet, to the top of a ridge, beyond which rose the main peaks. And so the first objective I was given, or rather Alan George and I were given, as sort of joint commanders of Charlie Company, take the company and secure that ridge and secure the railway line, and the battalion would follow.
Now, do you know what date this was?
No, I'm not sure if it's in that book.
I don't think it is. They can look it up anyway. Yeah. End of February,
yeah,
you think?
Beginning of March.
Right, they can look that up. Now, what happened in this attack? How did you prepare your men for it?
Well, the first thing was to get up. We had no idea we had no idea there was going to be any enemy there at all. The hope was that one could get up on the heights before the enemy did and do the usual thing that had been so successful at Agadat and Kerou, get round the flank of the enemy position, in which case we hoped they'd pull out. We set off across the plain towards from where the road was, got out of our lorries, towards this ridge, which seemed as good a place to start as anywhere. When we got up as far as the railway line, I think we did hear some shooting, so we knew there was some enemy not too far away. But by the time we got up, this very steep climb, certainly some people, for instance, PSM Galloway was finished. I mean, he just he couldn't take the weight and the stiff climb. And from the railway line, we could detect more firing, and we could very inaccurate because it was sort of miles over our heads. Difficult to quite see where it was coming from, but one could make a guess. So Alan George kept, I think he kept a form of perhaps a platoon back at the railway line, and I took two platoons up to try and find where this fire was coming from. And it was a hell of a job because the boulders were the size of small houses, and you had to pick a way around these. You didn't want to move in a bunch, because if you came around a corner and there was, this is where the Italians were, you were too easy a target. On the other hand, with these this rough hillside, steep slope, it was terribly easy to get the whole section so straggled out that it was no use as a unit. But we managed to keep them under control, more or less, shouting and this, that, and all. And fortunately, very good corporals in charge of the sections. And then we localized it a bit and found there were sort of two places that the fire was coming from. Again, well-sighted Italian machine gun posts, or light machine gun posts, one supporting the other from different angles. So it was quite obvious that which was the first one to go for. And
why?
Because if you could knock that one out, you would have a comparatively easy job climbing up parallel to and then above the other enemy post. And they'd been sighted just to prevent this.
Could you see them? Were they sangers, basically, or dug in?
I mean, it was a kind of, really, at the foot of a rock, they'd piled up other smaller stones and rocks to make sangers. And there were even more makeshift and temporary than the ones I'd been crucified for running up in the desert. And they obviously realised later they'd got there an hour before we had, if that, you know, as nip and tuck right now.